All right. So Charlie Mayer is with us today, and we want to see this intersection between mental health and exorcisms and demonic and the role of in how these two may or may not come together. And just to restate it, Charlie is not an exorcist. So what I want you to start with is, let's talk about your spiritual journey. How did you wind up in the ministries and vocation that you're in?
Okay. Well, it's good to be here. I grew up in a large United Methodist church on Long Island, and very, very early on had a sense of vocation. By the time I was
Yeah, but how old was
about
that?
15 or so,
Okay.
I had a pretty strong sense of vocation. But I was also a very serious musician, and that was what my heart wanted to do.
What
My
was your instrument?
my
Your
trum
instrument?
trombone.
Trombone.
Yeah. And I attended the Oberlin Conservatory and did my very best to fight God off for as long as I could. And finally it became clear to me that that wasn't going to happen. So after a couple of years of freelancing in Boston, I went to divinity school. And early on at divinity school, I had a lot of exposure to the liturgy of the Episcopal Church and really strongly considered exploring the Episcopal Church at that time. But as it turned out, I was being sponsored by my Methodist congregation. They had pr provided a scholarship for me, so it was difficult for me at that time to say no. So I was ordained in the Methodist Church and got involved in the liturgical renewal movement in the Methodist Church.
And so about when was this? So what
This
would you
was
say?
around 1982.
Okay.
At the liturgical renewal movement was a very vibrant movement. I felt very, very at home in it, but still didn't have the experience I had had in the Episcopal Church of liturgy. And it began to be clear to me that one of the differences was a different understanding of ordination and of priesthood.
So
Although
you were a pastor,
I was a pastor
right?
for 7 years full time. Alongside all of that, I was noticing that my strongest charism seemed to be counseling. I was doing a lot of pastoral counseling, I was doing a lot of premarital counseling, and also a lot of counseling with folks with addictions. This was all going on in my church office. So I went into my own therapy at that time to get some support for the work that I was doing, and finally decided that I wanted to train as a pastoral clinician. So I entered my training as a Methodist minister, and was involved in a 5-year clinical residency in New York City. And during that time, I noticed that I felt only more drawn to the liturgy and to the Episcopal Church. One of the reasons for that was that I noticed that so much of the symbolic work that I was doing with dreams related very closely to Christian symbolism. And I felt like the depth of that was expressed more fully in the Episcopal tradition than in the Methodist tradition.
So you're Jungian trained, or is or
Jungian and Freudian.
okay.
Yeah, kind of a blend. And then also marriage and family, family systems training.
Okay.
So all of those went on.
Yeah.
So I finally, near the end of my training, I took the plunge and I resigned my orders in the Methodist Church and got confirmed in the Episcopal Church and entered the ordination process in the Episcopal Church in the mid 1990s and was
So you were we were talking about this earlier today. So you were confirmed in the Methodist Church,
yes
but the confirmation was done locally
by the
by the
pastor,
pastor.
right?
Right. And then so in the Episcopal Church, we would require a bishop to
Right.
do the confirmation. So you went through that. You essentially quit your job, right? You resigned yourself
From my orders.
from your or not
Yes.
only, yeah, so not only did you resign your church, gave up your pastorate, but you left. You walked away from your ordination vows and then came over to the Episcopal Church, and they said, well, we might have you, but first you have to get confirmed, and then you had to do what? Tell me the next
Well,
step. So,
had pretty much to go through the entire ordination process.
wow.
And that included a year of Anglicization at General Seminary.
Yeah.
So
So you so what church were you at? Were you worshiping at in
I
New
was
York
at the
City?
Church of the Incarnation in Manhattan.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you were just a parishioner there. I mean, just a...
Well, the rector made me counseling associate,
Okay.
and so I did participate in the liturgy and
Okay.
did a lot of pastoral counseling there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were, yeah, just a really involved lay person, and they had to say, oh, we agree that you're, once again, you had to have your calling, what we considered a calling, affirmed by the local church.
Right.
And then the bishop, going through all the diocesan
Process.
process, which was what? Just what are the things that you had to do?
Well, I had eight interviews with members of the standing committee, and
Wow.
all eight of them had to say yes in order for me to
Yeah.
go forward.
Which is different than, like, for my ordination, I had three people with the Commission on Ministry, and only two had to say yes. So
Right.
your bar was much higher in that sense. You had to have
Yeah.
eight of the standing commission, which is a higher commission, and all of them say yes. Okay.
So it was quite an anxious time,
Yeah.
as you can
Yeah.
imagine.
Did you have to go through like a psychiatric test
Yes.
and the Rorschach test and the personality profile? So you had to do the whole shebang. You had to do the whole thing again, and you had probably presumably
I had done
gone
that before.
with the Methodist Church.
Yes. Yeah.
And this is all because you weren't confirmed by a bishop, or no, it's more than that.
It was more than that. Yeah.
And so during that time, were you allowed to go to General Seminary for your 1 year degree?
Yes.
Oh, so you were able to do at least to do that
Yes.
concurrently.
Yes.
Okay.
I was a candidate by the time I went to General Seminary.
And this was under Bishop Moore or
Bishop Grine.
Bishop Grine. Yes,
Yeah.
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're move so now we're in the 90s. You're moving through all this. You're hoping that people. That you get the yeses that you need
Right.
along the way, which are just the same. It's the same bars that we all that the seminarians and everyone has to go through,
Right.
and so you get the yeses. You graduate from general with your
Certificate, yes.
Anglican studies certificate, and then what happens
Well, all through that time, I was building a private practice
in New York
in New
City?
York
Yeah.
City. So this was happening alongside the process with the Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
So actually, that was a real respite for me. It was something that was familiar. It was a way that, to continue my routine while I was going through all these changes.
Wow.
So as soon as I was ordained, I became what Incarnation called the assistant minister.
Okay.
It was a very low church. And served as assistant minister for 2 years while continuing to have my practice on the side. And then from there, I began what became the pattern of the rest of my career, which was to be really full time in private practice and supplying almost every Sunday, and for periods of time supplying at one church for an extended time. So that, in terms of my vocational life, brings me to the present.
So just one detail, just to make sure that we get too churchy in our terms. So the low church, that statement, there are two things I would add. One is in New York City in particular, the Avenue churches, so Second Avenue, Fifth Avenue,
Madison.
Madison Avenue, which was
Right.
what Incarnation's on, all of those churches in New York City would be considered in church party lingo or language, this low broad church thing. So your title was minister instead of curate, assistant minister instead of curate, or any other title that's the case. And then in New York City, the cross streets, so 92nd Street or any of the other churches that are on those cross streets are considered high to or broad to high churches. So we would say that the low churches are more Protestant and the high churches are more Anglo-Catholic is another way to determine the terminology for it. So that's very typical in New York City, that Incarnation and Heavenly Rest and St. James Madison Avenue and others, St. Bartholomew's, all have a history of being those types of churches. So
That's right.
yeah, I just want to get that technical stuff. So here you are, you built a practice, a private practice in psychotherapy and counseling, presumably the same types of counseling that you did when you were when you started, or is it, how did it shift
Well,
and change?
now it was more long-term counseling.
Okay.
We're counseling in the church. I never counseled anyone for more than six sessions.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But now sometimes the therapy went on for years. So much longer term
Right.
psychotherapy.
Right.
And my training is thoroughly secular,
Okay.
as with a spiritual integration.
How did you did you how did you get that spiritual integration? Were you able to get that through coursework, or is it your personal
Both,
studies?
both.
Okay.
But the coursework at the in the residency that I was in for 5 years included courses in the integration of spirituality and mental
Okay.
health.
Which would have been pretty innovative
Yes, it
at
was
the time.
innovative, but I'll hasten to say there was nothing about demons
All right, fair enough.
anywhere
Yeah, yeah.
in my training.
So here, so we bring so we've gotten you caught up in where you are today and in your practice and kind of what would be a typical kind of counseling therapeutic practice, and you're been a priest for in the Episcopal Church for a long time. And so how, and I know that you counsel Episcopal priests as well, or people within the church. And so what is the advice like the primary advice you'd want to give to a group of students who've been taking a semester to study the evil, study the challenges of the demonic within life and within the Christian parish and or the life of a parish and church?
Rule out everything else. Is the first advice that I would give. And that the demonic is extraordinarily rare. I'm not sure I've encountered it in my practice. I've encountered it in other settings, but not in my practice. So it's something to be very, very cautious about.
Okay, good.
And I think one reason for that has to do with what we call in therapy countertransference. Right, that very often we see in the person that we're counseling elements of ourselves that we try to ignore. And so we wind up projecting onto the person that we're counseling. And one projection might be that that person is possessed or is evil in some way. So it's very, very important to examine
So
oneself.
what would be an example? What give us an example of what that might look like?
So I had a client that I'll call Stephen,
Okay.
who came in for therapy. He was a brilliant guy, an accomplished concert pianist who had done a lot of performing, and he was absolutely obsessed with what he called a heavenly mathematical library. And it was really all he could talk about when he came in. And I found it very unsettling to be with him. I really did. And I had to pay attention to that in myself. What was I unsettled about? And I finally decided to try an experiment with him. And I said, Stephen, you and I have a big problem because I'm not nearly as bright as you are. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to understand what you're talking about. And he said, I'll be very happy to adjust my commentary based on your limitations. And he did.
That's
And he stopped talking about the heavenly mathematical library
great.
and talking about what was really going on for him. So that for me was enough evidence that there wasn't any kind of demonic activity going on because I was able to engage him on a human level, right? So that's one example. But I could very easily have run with the idea that there was some kind of possession going on there, very much to his harm. So that's one
And do you
example.
think he was, it was, what would you have, in your professional opinion, diagnosed him with? I mean, what was it? It was just kind of an obsessive compulsiveness or a psychosis of some sort, or
Yeah, I would say he was a borderline personality with a major depression alongside it.
But he was casting it in this kind of spiritual aspect
He was.
that was really obfuscating what was happening in some ways.
Right.
Okay.
And I'm reminded of the way I've done some reading in preparation for being here today, of the church fathers and mothers and their classifications. They actually had classifications of mental illness, and they classified them according to three categories: the somatic, the demonic, and what they called the spiritual.
So the somatic, so that's of the body,
Body-based.
and what would that be? What would be an example?
An example of that would be someone who has an organic brain injury, okay, which is affecting their ability, their cognitive ability. That'd be one example. And the demonic is what we know to be the demonic. And then the spiritual they consider to be symptoms that occurred because of distortions of the will. And they said that very often the symptomology of the demonic and the spiritual was very similar. So that once again, it was important to kind of make the distinction between the two and to ascertain which one was going on. They also said that the prayers used in exorcism were often efficacious in cases of spiritual disorders.
So, give us an example of a spiritual disorder. We think just come up with another of one.
Okay. So,
Like a you give us a
yeah.
modern example.
So I had a client who came to me because he was wrestling with relationships with two different people. Roman Catholic guy. He had been to his priest who said, "Gotta choose." And came to me and wanted to know if I had ever worked with anyone like him before, and whether I was going to take a stand on what to do. And I said, "Well, why don't we explore the history of this and get an idea of what's going on with you," which was a proper therapeutic response. And it turned out that he was just the most superstitious person I've ever met in my life. He was always seeing black cats crossing the road in front of him. He'd come in almost every session reporting another black cat, and would be very, very anxious about that, and to the point of terror, and he was meanwhile leading this elaborate double life. And that was the distortion of the will. That's what was causing this symptomology in my mind. So the work was to help him resolve that and make a choice. But it certainly wasn't going to happen by me saying, pick this one or pick that one.
There was going to be a journey.
There was a journey. There was a
Well,
lot of work to do.
right, because he had to come to that place of admission and of what he's doing
That's right.
and the impact of that, as opposed to just living this. Well, one of the challenges, the secret that he was holding, and trying to hold that secret so tightly was causing probably a lot of his distress.
That's right.
And then resolving that is to acknowledge that he has this secret that is affecting him in outward ways in his personal life.
And once again, it would have been very easy for me to conclude that there was demonic activity going on with him.
Now, we might want to say, make the distinction in this class to say he's not possessed, and we would have, I think the class here and myself would have certainly agree with you that on the rarity of possession, that to give up the humans, for a human to lose their own agency is a very extreme event. It just we're not built in a way to lose, just to give up our agent, to give up our personal self, in our body, in our essence, in our soul. We're just not built that way. We're together. So, but in there are instances when that happens. That said, we might ask, well, perhaps this person is been following this life out of demonic pressure or influence or some sort of perhaps even a evil, just kind of almost like a crustacean that's on him, that kind of sense of it, the evil has been grounded into him in a way. Do you see, but I what I'm hearing from you is that it may not matter in it whether that's true or not, in terms of it on some level, it's almost irrelevant because he still has to work through his process of letting go of the secret and being just and acknowledging who he is.
But the notion would be that if he really wasn't able to do that, that would be an indicator that there's probably some a demonic activity going on. But he was able to. He was a, he responded to the therapeutic interventions and was able to work through the process.
And what's your view of, I mean, you have to walk a line kind of professionally around prayer and spiritual activities in your psychotherapy practice versus as a priest and a counseling somebody in a church setting. How do you navigate that? Because that's, clearly, you don't show up at the psychotherapy office in your collar,
I
perhaps.
don't,
And
I dress more and more casually as I get older. So prayer is a part of my practice. I will use it only with people who have indicated that they would like it to be something that goes on in the work. So I've done entire therapies with many people without using prayer at all. But if I'm working with someone who is there because I'm a pastoral therapist and wants that to be a part of the work, then yes, it can be. I would never, though, in my private office, attempt an exorcism.
Right, right, right,
That's
right. And so let me ask, and why not?
well, because it's potentially unsafe.
Okay. How so? How so?
Well, I think that it could only worsen the person's situation.
Okay.
I think that's my main concern would be harm to the demon-possessed individual, but it could also be harm to me,
Okay.
right?
Yeah.
So I think that this has to take place in community.
Okay.
I think that
Good.
there has to be community surrounding the exorcism, and certainly in going back to what I've learned about the church fathers and mothers, they would house demon-possessed people in the monastic setting. And live alongside them, as they worked in prayer to exorcise them.
Okay, good,
Yeah.
good. And you mentioned, because my students are not going to let this go, so I'm going to
Right.
ask it to you because they're just going to ask, and it will be interesting to for those that are that are going to watch this later. Is you mentioned that you may have encountered evil outside of the clinical practice. So can you speak to that a little bit, or your understanding? Just yeah, because it's
Yeah.
you
Well,
want to know.
I think that I've encountered it in parish settings. I've certainly had disturbances during worship, right, from people who were behaving in a
Right.
blasphemous way.
Okay.
I know that's I'm talking about one or two instances in 40 years, but I have had that experience.
Right.
And in those cases, I consulted with higher powers than myself, right? And tried eventually to intervene in the life of the people involved.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Good.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to break it off there, and we're going to go into question and answers because I get the feeling that there's going to be a few. So
Okay.
thanks for this.
You're
And
so welcome.
yeah,
Yeah.
and I really appreciate you being a part of us.
You bet.
Yeah. Good.